Welcome to another podcast recorded at the 5th annual STEG conference held in the Economics Department at the University of Oxford. My name is Tim Phillips. STEG is a research initiative that aims to provide a better understanding of structural change, productivity, and growth in low and middle-income countries. We know that inequality has an impact on development, but there are many types of inequality and many ways to measure it. One of its most important dimensions, especially at the early stages of the transformation of an economy, is land inequality. Harrison Mitchell of UC San Diego is one of a team of researchers that is investigating the relationship between rural landholding inequality in one large state in India, agricultural productivity, and the emergence of other ways to earn money. Harrison, welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So Harrison, what do we know so far about the relationship between land inequality and inequality of income?
The short answer is we don't know too much about this relationship. We generally think that land is a big part of somebody, especially in developing countries, somebody's assets. And So sort of there's a mechanical relationship between the wealth you have in land and then something related to your income. But what's unique about land is it's also a direct means of production because you can produce output as a farmer on it. And so the relationship there is something that hasn't been fully examined, and we're taking a crack at that.
We're also here at a conference talking about structural transformation. What do we know about the relationship between land inequality and structural transformation?
There's been some more work, and we're trying to bridge maybe two strands of literature that have looked at this topic. One is some earlier theoretical work in the 90s that relates how the initial conditions of land and that distribution can impact structural change, but this is much more theoretical. And then there's also work related to how the distribution of land affects productivity. So we might think that land is misallocated in different countries, and if we were able to reallocate this, what would this do to agricultural productivity overall? There we have a nice understanding of some general trends around land inequality and production, but we don't necessarily know how those changes would then map back into structural transformation, and in particular, attaching good estimates and good relationships with nice data here, which isn't necessarily theoretical or looking at just different countries and things like that. And so we're taking a much more micro view.
Yes, you have some quite remarkable data in this. You'll be looking at India for your work, in which I was surprised to find out that land inequality is very persistent. Why is that?
The quick answer here is there's sort of a missing market for land in India. The primary way, sort of the vast, vast majority of people get the land that they own is through inheritance. Somewhere around 95% of agricultural land was passed down, essentially, between families. And so already you can see how it's so persistent just with that feature. But then, especially in India, because of the cultural persistence of the Jati or caste system, where most marriage is within the same caste, we not only have this inheritance norm, but also this norm, which is just, it's sticking where earlier families had it.
So if I'm a farmer in India, I'm a talented farmer, I'm good at my job, and I want to cultivate more land, where do I get it?
The unfortunate answer there is most of the time you can't. Oh. If you're talented and you want to expand your own land holdings, even if you are a talented land farmer and you have your own land, it's difficult to expand that because of these missing markets. It's nearly impossible to buy land. And while there are some instances of being able to sort of lease land from some nearby larger landowner, the legality of that and the practicality of those contracts has made it so that it's rare in India. And I think what's even more important here is you could be a talented farmer, but if you own no land, then there's no way for you to even buy the land in the first place to start farming.
We're going to talk more in detail about India, but is this something that is unique to India, or do we find these missing markets in land in other countries as well?
I think it's pretty common globally, both historically and even today in many developing countries, we see these frictions in land markets. Lots of times it depends on different cultural or institutional factors. So for instance, there's been work showing that the lack of formal titles to land has incentivized people to sort of hold on to their land, because even if there in that context, it would be possible to sell your land, because you have no formal title, the other person is less willing to buy the land because they don't know if maybe other people are going to acknowledge that that purchase was completed, or if somebody else is going to try and claim the land or something like this. And even in a historical context, the mature land markets that we think are prevalent in developed countries are pretty recent. In the last 100 years or so is where we've seen that, but it's been persistent throughout both space and time.
So in your work, you've studied the interaction, frictions in land and credit markets. I imagine adding credit markets to this has made it a lot more complicated. Why did you include them?
There's been lots of work showing how important credit market frictions are for deterring entry into productive sectors or scaling up or things like this. And what's echoing back to earlier, since land is a productive asset in and of itself, we wanted to allow for the fact that if you had land and you're a farmer, you could self-finance your way into starting a different business outside of agriculture by using the profits from farming to begin with. If you don't allow for credit market frictions, people could just receive a loan and select into whatever they want frictionlessly. And so this interaction is important to us.
So this is kind of like a micro story of structural change, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. The model we're using is definitely very sort of micro-founded, and we have a bunch of different agents that are deciding in what occupation to work, how many people to hire, if they're a business owner, things like this. And then our data also is very micro-level, so we think that's a nice pairing.
I would imagine that you would need quite detailed data for this. So where do you find this? Which region do you study in India?
I have to be careful here. Our data is from a state in India, and we're not allowed to disclose where due to non-disclosure agreements.
I see.
This is because the data we have is land registration records, which allow us to identify the name of an individual and their land holdings. And so we've used this data to then merge it with other available census and microdata, which not only gives us the information about land holdings, but now we can also know in what occupation do people work in this household, how many years of education do they have, and what's their family size. And this connection between not only the land holdings, but also these other rich demographic and economic variables is very sensitive, which is why we're not allowed to disclose where we get this data, but also a very unique aspect of this project.
So we will say an Indian state.
Yes.
For which you have to have some measure of land inequality. How do you represent land inequality?
The most straightforward way, and the way we primarily do this in our paper, is we use a Gini index. For each village, we construct a Gini index for land inequality, but we show that this Gini index captures a lot of other measures of inequality quite well. So for instance, we estimate if we assume land is distributed from a Pareto distribution, which has these big tails where we have sort of really big landowners, then we're able to estimate that Pareto shape parameter and things look very similar, whether or not we're looking at the relationship between the Gini and structural transformation or the Pareto shape parameter and structural transformation.
So let's go back to where we started. Do you find a relationship between land inequality and agricultural productivity or wages, some kind of income measure?
At the aggregate level, we can say a good amount about this relationship. So we see that in villages with higher land inequality, there's more adoption of sort of profitable agricultural technology. So this would be things like irrigation, tractors, these sort of modern agricultural methods, which we think are very correlated with increased agricultural productivity. We don't necessarily see an individual's agricultural productivity, so we can't say much there. But then we also received some funding from STEG to go to these villages and conduct surveys at the village level to collect data on wages across different sectors, prices around the rental rate of different things, And so there we have seen that additionally, higher inequality places have higher wages. And so this is a nice feature where we think we're seeing higher productivity in agriculture and then also higher wages. We generally think a good measure of welfare.
So is the thinking behind that, is the mechanism behind that, if you have larger landholders, they can afford to invest in these things?
We think that this modern agriculture is more input intensive. So you have to hire labor that's coming from outside your own household. You have to adopt irrigation. You have to maybe pay for like a tractor or a drum seeder or something like this. And so because of that, as you have more and more land, so as some amount of this distribution has more land because you're increasing the land inequality, you are going to see an increased adoption rate of these profitable technologies because more people pass that threshold where the traditional agricultural methods are now less productive than the modern.
This is similar in a way to the argument that some economists make that India has too many small farms.
Right. So there's lots of work that's showing that in India and other places, there's too many small farms, too many small firms, lots of sort of misallocation where we think that all of these firms that we're seeing, it would be beneficial to everyone if they could become larger and maybe that we'd have fewer firms, for instance, but there'd be returns to scale. And so we would think that this would help everyone overall. And so this is related to work that's shown there's a nonlinear relationship in farm size and productivity, where as you start to try and increase your farm size and hire outside labor, maybe your productivity is decreasing because it's hard to sort of manage these contracts. But then as you get to a certain level of farm size, that gain from outside labor and capital inputs outweighs the downside of some of these frictions.
Okay, so now help me by bringing in the price or the availability of credit. What additionally does this tell us?
What was interesting in our context when we went to collect this data is we didn't see much of a relationship between land inequality and the price of credit.
Uh-huh.
And so our thinking there and sort of something that we try to incorporate into the model is that lots of these technologies and the capital that's coming into these villages that allows for more modern agricultural practices is actually produced outside of the rural area and more in cities or even outside of the country. We can think of these villages as almost small open economies where the interest rate and this price of credit is set externally by this big, large city and this global market. And we're, as farmers, just having to face that interest rate.
From what you see in the raw data here, is the state of land inequality, is it incentivizing that transition, that structural change to starting non-agricultural businesses, or is it standing in its way?
It seems like from both our data and the model that as you see higher rates of land inequality, we do see more non-agricultural businesses. So this could be due to this factor that we were discussing earlier about how the higher rates of land inequality have allowed certain individuals to self-finance their own entrepreneurial businesses. And so we see in our data that close to 80% of entrepreneurs report that they self-financed their firm. This echoes what we see.
Okay, so you mentioned your model. You did create a model to evaluate potential policy reforms, what we could do about this that would be beneficial to both people who live in India and the Indian economy, I guess. What assumptions do you make about the process of structural transformation?
We've taken the approach to write down a model that takes as its inputs some standard features of other papers in sort of the macro development space around the decision to adopt productive technology in agriculture or not, or the decision to become an entrepreneur or not. And so we basically have individuals that have different productivities in either agriculture or entrepreneurship. They have a land endowment, which we're going to treat as fixed because of these missing markets to land. And then you can accumulate assets and you can make a decision on which occupation you want to be in. So you can either work as a wage laborer. If you have land, you can cultivate agriculture and you can be a traditional farmer or a modern farmer where you adopt irrigation, for instance, or you can become an entrepreneur. And so before we get to counterfactuals and policy prescriptions. We just wanted to say, okay, let's write down this model. Let's try and calibrate it to match the data that we have. And how does this model explain the rates of structural transformation that we see as it relates to the Gini? And so, for instance, in our model, if we change the land inequality, we're going to see reallocation across different sectors. So we're going to see people moving into irrigated agriculture, moving into wage labor because of this increased labor demand. And so how does our model compare to the data? At the moment, what we're finding is that while the model can produce the sign of these relationships, so we see what we see in the data there, the magnitudes are a little off. And so what we're trying to do there is we're trying to more explain how this model is differing from the data, and then what could be explaining those differences that we're seeing.
What might be the differences?
I think one important difference that we're examining and hoping to expand on is that in our model, we're assuming that an individual's productivity doesn't depend on their land endowment. So right. Basically, in our model, we're taking a land distribution and we're just throwing it onto the economy, and we don't care about the productivity of individuals as they get the land. So you could be extremely productive in agriculture and not receive any land. You could be extremely unproductive in agriculture and you could receive a lot of land. In reality, and in the data in particular, we might think this is not the case, and that actually there's some correlation between an individual's productivity or their human capital or something like this and the land that they own. This could be true both within a village, where we might think that the higher productive individuals hold more land, and so this isn't captured in the model, or it might be just a level effect where higher inequality villages overall have higher education measures and things like this. Some current work we're doing on this project is we're examining those relationships, and we do see those things where high inequality villages have higher rates of average education. It seems like higher inequality places across the board, regardless of your landholding, have higher rates of education. And then within higher land inequality villages, we see that the correlation, so the relationship between landholding and years of education, is stronger. In high inequality places, it seems like the more productive people do have more land, whereas in lower inequality places, that's not necessarily the case. These are things that we've left out of the model, but hopefully is obvious. The productivity is directly related to these things, and we're hoping to incorporate that into the model and see if that can sort of explain the divergence between the data and the model.
Good luck with that. That sounds like more than a few hours of work. Sitting behind all of this is the idea of the model, the idea that some kind of land reform policy could accelerate the process of structural transformation.
The primary purpose of this paper is, at the moment, more of an accounting exercise to see how well our current models in macro development can explain what we see in the data with this novel data that we have and this question that sort of hasn't been tackled directly with these models.
Yeah.
Land reform itself is a hard policy to enact, and there's lots of complications there. And so a unique feature of this project is we could see both how maybe some of these policies could impact things, or also how other changes to the institutional environment could also affect structural transformation, taking as given these frictions in the land market and this inequality. So one example would be, if we improve credit markets, how does this then interact with this existing land inequality and frictional labor markets to undo some of the frictions that we might be seeing without necessarily undergoing large land reform itself?
Right, because land reform policy, as you say, is very difficult, especially if that land reform policy would lead to more concentration of land ownership, which would seem from your statistical exercise to be something that might be positive for structural transformation.
Yeah, so definitely land reform is tricky as a policy, precisely because of what you were saying, where if at least on one side of land reform policies, this could lead to an increase in land concentration. And I think this isn't necessarily politically feasible, and there's large implications about the heterogeneous effects of a policy like that, where we might have maybe the average productivity is increasing, but there could be definitely some positive and negative winners and losers. What we're hoping to do is see what other sorts of external investments in these local areas could do there to speed up structural transformation in different ways that might be more feasible as a policymaker. So examples could be potentially education reform, where because we see with our data this strong relationship between education and land holdings, maybe targeted investments in education could potentially give us structural transformation without maybe some of the complications around land reform itself. Another example could be, for instance, opening factories up in these villages could provide an alternative demand, and this could then generate these increases in wage employment without necessarily having to reallocate land itself. Manaswini, who's a co-author on this paper, uses the same data in an earlier paper. She finds that for villages that are nearby to cities, there's lots of out-migration. People in these villages are migrating to the cities. This is causing some interesting dynamics related to land inequality, because you have a certain section of the land distribution leaving villages. And then also structural transformation, because this is then having knock-on effects on who is in these villages and what occupations are they working in.
Fascinating questions to consider with no easy answers either. Harrison, thank you very much.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
This work is at an early stage, so look out for it. The paper is called Land Inequality and Rural Structural Transformation, Evidence from India. And the authors are Francis Liu, Harrison Mitchell, and Manashwini Rao.